Welcome to Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Our website is econtalk.org, where you can subscribe, comment on this podcast, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives, where you can listen to every episode we've ever done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is July 19th, 2019, and my guest is Andrew Roberts. His latest book is Churchill, Walking with Destiny. Among his other books are History of World War II, The Storm of War, and Napoleon, A Life. Andrew, welcome to Econ Talk, and I should add that as far as I know, we are not related.
Thank you, Russ.
Our topic today is Churchill, the man, and the craft of biography. And I want to start with your recently published biography of Churchill. Give me an idea of the nuts and bolts of writing a book like this, a 982-page biography of a man who has already seen quite a few words written about him already. Was there a typical day? And I'm curious how you leveraged the work you'd already done writing a history of World War II.
Yes. Well, in fact, there are 1,009 biographies of Churchill that have already been published. So there's, as you say, there's quite a lot. A typical day breaks down either the research side, which I did for 3 years and 9 months, or the actual writing side, which I did in 100 days. And considering the book is 500,000 words long, I was averaging 5,000 words a day. I get up at 4:30 in the morning and start working immediately. I work downstairs at home. And then I go through until lunchtime. The great thing is, of course, for the first 5 hours, nobody phones you or gets in touch with you. I then have a short and light lunch, and I drink a can of Red Bull, the caffeine drink, which is disgusting, actually. It's probably incredibly bad for you, but nonetheless, it keeps me shakingly awake until all the way through the afternoon when I continue to work, and then I get an early night's sleep.
5,000 words a day.
Yes.
It's about 20 pages, is that right?
I know what I'm going to write, of course, and I've got the basis of the outline of each chapter worked out. And yes, it's hard work, but it's very good to be able to have it done in such a short period in time, the 3 months, because you can then concentrate on the on rewrites and edits and so on. Psychologically, it's good too, because it means that the sheer concentration of effort is such that you can keep all the balls rolling in your head at the same time. But my wife says that I did do something rather unhygienic, which was during the Dardanelles chapter 10, which is quite a complicated chapter. She says that I was in my dressing gown and slippers for 3 days and didn't wash, which I don't remember particularly, but nonetheless, she's usually right about that kind of thing.
Now, you said you have an outline. Do you have, you also have, you know, voluminous footnotes in the book. Have you created a set of note cards to get you to that point? Files on your computer? What's the...
Yes, I mean, the key thing is to integrate the files that you have regarding various aspects of Churchill and the right place to insert them in the narrative. And, of course, especially somebody like Churchill who changed his mind on a number of things, you have to come back to various issues as well. So it's a constant battle, really, to make sure that you know that the reader knows what's going on.
Now, you said there's 1,009 biographies of Churchill, approximately. We'll just say over 1,000. That's a big number.
No, mine is the 1,010th, according to Ron Cohen, who is the world expert on Churchill biographers.
Yeah. And I think I heard you say at a talk you gave that Churchill himself wrote either 5 or 6.1 million words?
Yes, 5.2 million words. 5.2. And he spoke 6.1 million. Ah. And and he was his own biographer in many ways, because an awful lot of the things he said were about himself. And so he did analyze himself extremely assiduously and very often very accurately.
So I have read his History of World War II, and I am one of the rare non-historians, I suspect, who has also read the memos that are at the back of each of those volumes, because they're extraordinary. He was an amazing writer generally and an amazing memo writer. he was a real craftsman. I assume he knew he was writing for history, and it must have affected that.
Very much. But of course, he had been a writer with the 37 books that he wrote and the 800-plus articles that he wrote, and having been the best-paid war correspondent in the world at one point, very early on in his life, he was a master wordsmith. He was a huge reader, of course, also. And so he was somebody who mastered the English language. And so those memos that you refer to have so many wonderful nuggets in them. They are, many of them, completely sublime. And it was one of the best fun bits of the book, was reading those memos and drawing out some of the better ones.
So my slightly awkward question is, of the 5.2 million words that he wrote, I'm curious how many of those you read and how many of those 1,009 biographies you've read, and if you have any favorites among either Churchill's books or biographies about Churchill.
I have not read the other 1,009. I deliberately actually didn't read any that were written during after his lifetime. I didn't want to be affected by that. I wanted to read all the ones that were written whilst he was still alive, or at least all the ones that I could. I've read all the books that he's written, some since university, and I've read, I would say, 3/4 of his articles. I have to say, the speeches when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer on tax reform and things like that, I have missed out. But the huge majority of his speeches I've read as well, yeah.
Are you going to read any of those other biographies now that you're done?
No. I'm going to concentrate on my next book. I'm like everybody. I've got a mortgage.
And you don't. You're going to put Winston. You're going to say farewell to Winston in some dimension.
I think au revoir, rather than farewell. I would love to come back to him at some stage, but I think I've said everything that I've got to say about him now.
And as a biographer, you wrote a acclaimed biography of Napoleon, and I suspect, just guessing, that your feelings about Napoleon are not the same as your feelings about Churchill. How does that reflect on that experience of spending years immersed in a person's thoughts and experiences who you don't know, can't meet, and now the book is done? Is there an issue of hagiography for you that you fought against, or the opposite, perhaps, in the case of Napoleon? I don't know your feelings about him, but what's that like?
Well, yes, you certainly must guard against hagiography. Nobody wants to read a hagiography. Churchill himself pointed out that hagiographies are boring. But it wasn't difficult, because Churchill made blunder after blunder in his life. He got women's suffrage wrong. He got the gold standard wrong, abdication crisis, black and tans, the Gallipoli campaign. So it's not as though one is faced with a paragon who never made a mistake. But as he himself told his wife, Clementine, I should have made nothing if I had not made mistakes. And so the interesting thing for me was the way in which he learned from his mistakes to an extraordinary degree. So this is, in a sense, a redemptive story of a man who made mistakes but learned from them. The classic example, of course, being in the Second World War, he never overruled his chiefs of staff. And because he didn't want to make the same mistakes as he'd made a quarter of a century earlier with the Dardanelles campaign. And with Napoleon, it was a little bit different, because being an English historian, one starts off with a very negative view of Napoleon. When I was being taught at school, he was a proto-Hitler figure, especially as I was taught by teachers who grew up in the Second World War. Some of them had even fought in the Second World War, and so there was a very much a sense that he was an evil foreign dictator who wanted to invade Britain. When I looked into it more carefully and worked for 7 years on that book, I realized that this was rubbish. He was, of course, a foreign dictator, but he was a benevolent and benign dictator for most of the time, and also had a wonderful sense of humor, and was somebody who was able to get the best bits of the French Revolution and keep them whilst getting rid of all the horrific sides like the terror and the guillotine.
So let's talk about the mistakes that you alluded to that Churchill made in his career and his life. You know, it's hard to define a mistake. The Dardanelles, for those who don't know, was a catastrophic
strategic idea that Churchill championed didn't work out in World War One, but of course it might have. And so many things in life are uncertain going into them. And it's not clear that the right lesson was to never overrule your chiefs of staff. That was what he took from it that worked for him. And I don't know if it was a good idea in World War II or not. Maybe there were times he should have overruled his chiefs of staff. There are advantages to having a policy, of course. But it's what's extraordinary to me is how he got a second chance. Could easily have not have gotten that second chance, and all whatever lessons he learned would not have been relevant.
He got a fifth chance.
Yeah.
I mean, he was coming back. He was the ultimate comeback kid, really. He was again and again in and out of office. He was, as I say, somebody who learned from his mistakes. I think that you can, with the benefit of 100 years of hindsight, work out what was a mistake or not. The Gallipoli campaign actually is a very interesting one because it was a brilliant idea strategically to try to get the Royal Navy from the Eastern Mediterranean off the through the Dardanelles Straits and anchor it off Constantinople, modern-day Istanbul. If we'd done that and threatened to shell Istanbul, we could have taken the Ottoman Empire out of the First World War. It would have been one of the great strategic coups of the history of warfare. However, in the implementation of it by the admirals, not by Churchill, who was back in London at the time, but by the admirals, we managed to lose six ships in the course of one day on the 18th of March 1915. And then, because of Churchill, they doubled down on the defeat. And this is they landed the largest expeditionary force up in history up until that point. And over the next 8 months, we lost 147,000 killed and wounded. And so I think really it would be a very, very brave historian to say that it was anything other than a catastrophe. But the lessons that he learnt are very many, not just not to overrule the chiefs of staff, which he was overall absolutely right not to do in the Second World War, in my opinion. But he also learnt not to double down on defeat. And so when on occasions like the Dakar raid or the Norwegian campaign or the Greek expedition, he had an opportunity, to a lesser extent Anzio, he had an opportunity to just throw more men in. He very often didn't. He called off the operation before it turned into another Gallipoli. So, you know, this is an example. Not all politicians learn on the job, but in my view, Winston Churchill did.
Now, you say he didn't overrule chiefs of staff, but my understanding of his handling of the day-to-day war in World War II is that he was quite involved with the strategic and tactical decisions at a very micro level, including weaponry and so on. Is that accurate?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Absolutely, yes. He would go down to the details of whether or not sailors should play checkers or backgammon on boats, and how many anoraks should be worn. What's the American word for anorak?
Raincoat.
Yes, exactly.
A poncho.
Yes, exactly. How many ponchos per vessel there needed to be, and all of that kind of thing. There was nothing that was considered too small for his interest. But as I say, that's not the same thing as overruling the chiefs of staff when all three of them are agreed on a strategic decision.
What's your opinion of Churchill as an historian? Obviously, if he had never entered politics, he'd be a famous man. He'd be acclaimed in some dimension. We'd have heard of him. So one of the things that strikes me about his career is the vast scope of it. It's not just he was a politician. It wasn't just a prime minister. He was chancellor of the exchequer. He was a military commander. He was a soldier in the Boer War with, you know, deliberately, at least in his own words, taking risks, because I think he thought that would advance his career if he lived. But as an historian, what's his standing?
I think, although there are books about the mistakes he made in his histories of the First World War and the Second World War, on neither occasion did he claim them to be objective history. He claimed them to be his story. And they certainly are that. You know, he places himself in the center of the great events of the day. I think with regard to his history of the English-speaking peoples, it's one of the reasons he won the Nobel Prize for Literature, but it's more literature than history, frankly. He has Alfred burning the cakes as a historical fact, for example, rather than an analogy which most people, or at least a legend that most people now most historians would assume it was.
That's the English king who incognito wandered into a thatched hut and was put to the job of cooking, right, and then burned the woman of the house yells at him.
Yes, exactly. He was thinking too much about how to defeat the Vikings. He was a great Saxon king, that he allowed the cakes that he was supposed to be watching over to burn. It's a very old story. It's clearly a myth of some kind, but it's an oral myth that probably had some kind of basis in fact at some stage. Anyway, and Churchill just tells it as though it's a true story, and not many people would do that. Not many historians today would do that. However, he is an extremely good historian when it comes to the history of his great ancestor, the first Duke of Marlborough. He wrote a four-volume biography in the 1930s at that time, and that is really first-class history, and most military historians, when looking at Marlborough's campaigns, would go to him even today, 70 years later, 80 years later, as one of the primary sources.
So it's extraordinary that he found time to write multi-volume histories of his ancestors, World War I, World War II, the English-speaking people. He didn't sleep much. Is that correct?
No, it's not really. He did actually. He
was a napper, I think.
He had a nap, which is
God
bless
him.
His way of turning one day into two, as he pointed out. So he would start working in bed at 8 o'clock in the morning, and then he would go and stay in bed until noon. Then he'd get up, have a bath, have lunch, work through in the afternoon, and then at some stage he would have another three quarters of an hour to an hour in the afternoon prior to then working in the evening. So he would basically get 2 days out of one day.
Now, those kind of facts that you just recounted, where do we know those from? I ask you because you say you haven't read the standard biographies written since he was they're only the ones while he was alive, or right? So how did you discover his daily habits?
Maybe I should temper that by saying that over the years I've read Martin Gilbert's 8-volume biography and also his 1-volume biography, and I've been asked to review over the years I'd say 100 or so Churchill books, not necessarily biographies. So it's not true that I hadn't read any at all since he died. That's a wild exaggeration. But
you didn't study them in preparation for your book.
I didn't. No. And I've already written 5 books on Churchill, at least with Churchill in the title or the subtitle. So there, I already had a pretty good, I thought, grounding in the main sort of modern controversies and so on. And how do you find out about his naps? Well, his private secretary writes about it. 3 of his other secretaries write about it. And I think at one point he might have mentioned it in an essay as well. So all in all, it's not difficult to do.
You mentioned controversies. He was an avid drinker, but I've heard you say he was not an alcoholic. Talk about his drinking habits. He was a Scotch drinker, if I remember correctly, and he had a favorite brand. What was that brand, and how much Scotch did he drink a day, and why do you possibly claim he's not an alcoholic?
He didn't have a favorite brand of Scotch. It was champagne. Paul Roger champagne was his favorite, although he was perfectly happy to drink other champagnes and indeed other Scotches, and he enjoyed white wine and red wine as well. So that's just yet another of the myths about him.
I thought he nursed a Scotch from dawn to dusk, dawn to sleeping.
from about 6 o'clock in the evening until he went to bed, he would have a glass of Scotch on the go. But it was, as his last private secretary, Sir Anthony Montague Brown, told me, essentially mouthwash. There was an enormous amount of soda and very little whiskey. And they were told off if they put too much whiskey in it. He was a great drinker, and he had an iron constitution for alcohol. In the 2,194 days of the Second World War, there's only one day on which Churchill got drunk. And on that occasion, on the 7th of March 1944, what they decided at the end of the Defence Committee of the War Cabinet to do was to, because they all recognised that the Prime Minister was drunk, was to hold the same meeting the next morning as though the last one hadn't happened. So there's no example of a decision being taken because the Prime Minister was drunk. Somebody who knew him quite well, the journalist C.P. Scott, said that Winston Churchill couldn't have been an alcoholic because no alcoholic could have drunk that much. And he authored. Exactly. He enjoyed sort of showing off about his how much he drank. But in fact, it was something, I think he himself put it best when he said that alcohol was always his servant and never his master, and that he had taken more out of alcohol than alcohol had taken out of him.
There's a common view that he suffered from what he supposedly called the black dog, a form of depression. Is that true?
I don't believe so, no. He only mentions black dog once in his whole life that we know of, and that's in July 1911 when he's writing to his wife, at a time that the phrase was used by Edwardian matrons for ill-tempered children. He chaired over 900 meetings of the Defence Committee of the War Cabinet. It was... depression, of course, is a debilitating illness, and I don't believe he suffered from any kind of chemical imbalance, let alone manic depression or bipolar, as I've read in some places. So, I'm not a believer in this.
We talk a lot in this program about the virtues of humility and being able to say, "I don't know." That doesn't strike me as a virtue of Churchill's. At least his public persona was extraordinarily confident and then perhaps overconfident. And that was certainly the case during his public persona in the Battle of Britain and afterwards, at least as far as I understand it. One could certainly argue that was appropriate at the time, necessary.
Vital might be another word,
yeah,
yes.
Because his whole... demeanor at that point was resistance and courage. Reflect on his personality. Do you think he had moments where he despaired? I mean, the war took a horrible turn for a long, long time. It's hard to, you know, for us looking back on it who didn't live through it, to realize how easy it could have been to give up at so many different times.
Yes, that's right. I mean, as I say, I don't believe that he was depressive, but he did get depressed at moments in the Second World War, such as the fall of Singapore or the fall of Tobruk, or any number of terrible things that happened. And but those are moments when any sentient decision maker would have got depressed. He was not a humble man at all. No, I'm afraid that side of this program, there's absolutely no example I can give you of any feeling of... I mean, he himself said, about the day he became Prime Minister, he said that he went to sleep perfectly calm because he had never suffered from any feelings of personal inadequacy or anything of that sort. And, you know, he was the son of grandson of a duke. He was born in a palace. He had the education for leadership at Harrow and Sandhurst that drummed into him that he was expected to be a great man. He had survived any number of close brushes with death in his life, which gave him a sense of personal destiny. And you get this very much, and it's the reason I subtitled the book Walking with Destiny. You get this very much from that moment, the day on which he became Prime Minister on the 10th of May 1940, when he said, "I felt as if I were walking with destiny and that all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial." And so that is not the kind of remark that any kind of humble person... I mean, we'd had enough of humility in the 1930s. We were humble before Hitler again and again in the during the appeasement years. It was not what the British people needed in May 1940.
So I heard you speak a couple of weeks ago, and I speak fairly often, and I've spent some time thinking about how to deliver a speech, in particular... how much to write down. And when I was younger, I wrote almost nothing down. I would just have it in my mind, have it in my head, and I knew how it was going to go. And then at some point, I realized I was leaving out things now and then. And I decided my style now is I write it out word for word, and I don't deliver it word for word. I deliver it spontaneously, but I have my notes to go back to, and I force myself to go back to them to make sure I haven't left important points out. My understanding is that Churchill... had a moment speaking in the in Parliament where he lost his train of thought, couldn't regain it. The same thing happened to his father. It was the end of his father's career, and he panicked, and after that changed the way he spoke. Is that true?
Yes, it was the Trades Disputes Act of April 1904, and he'd been in Parliament for 4 years, and he was 30 years old, and he used to memorize speeches word for word and speeches that would go on for an hour. And he had a phonographic memory, which is like a photographic memory, but it's for sounds. And he could remember phrases and quotations and so on. At one point as a boy at school, he was able to recite 1,200 lines of Macaulay's Lays of Ancient Rome without a mistake. And so he was able to do this, and then on that particular day in April 1904, he had to sit down because he completely lost his train of thought.
And they tried to help him, and
well, a lot of people around him were very worried because, as you mentioned, his father had died of a rare brain disease, and they feared that this was striking the 30-year-old Churchill. And so what he did from then on was to use what he called psalm form, in which there would every sentence would be boiled down to 5 or 6 words that he would then write out in the form of a psalm, in that they were in the middle of the page, and he would speak from those kind of notes. And on occasion, he would be able to go through an entire page without looking down, but mostly he did look down, and he used pregnant pauses to as rhetorical devices and so on. So he was a self-taught public speaker, and he actually thought about the theory of public speaking and wrote an article at the age of 23, before he'd even given a public speech in his life, about the theory of public speaking.
I want to talk about modern England, and, you know, as a casual observer of England, visited a couple times. I have some family living there now. I get the sense that there's an unease of modern educated English men and women with their imperial past. That's an unease that Churchill would have found perplexing. He was, I think, as far as I can tell, quite proud of the Britain and England of the past. Is that true about England today, that there's a shame, actually, is the way I would describe it?
Yes, I think ever since the 1960s, there's been shame has been taught in the schools as a direct response to Britain's imperial past. And, of course, if something carries on like that for half a century, it's going to sort of drip into the consciousness of most people. You're right about Churchill. He was proud of Britain's imperial past. He thought that it was a glorious moment in British history, and that for most of the history of the empire, it was a very good thing for the native peoples of the empire, on so many levels. And so that's one of the reasons that his reputation is being attacked at the moment, and people are denouncing him, and and daubing his statue and generally attacking him and representations of him physically, I mean, as well as intellectually. I think it's a great shame. I think it's a ridiculous way to look at somebody who grew up whilst Charles Darwin was still alive, when people believe that the hierarchy of races, which we rightly consider today to be absurd and obscene, nonetheless, in those days, was taught as part of science. It was believed to be a scientific fact. And the fact that somebody like Churchill acted on that and tried to use the best impulses as a result and tried to make the native peoples as prosperous as possible, the idea that he should be attacked for that strikes me as just entirely ahistorical.
You, at the very end of your book, you list a number of the revisionist attacks that have been made on Churchill, not so much his attitudes, but his actions. And in particular, I know that when I interviewed Thomas Ricks about his book, Churchill and Orwell, I think it was then, a number of listeners were upset that I did not bring up the Indian famine. Yeah. And that Churchill was responsible for the deaths of, I think, and people claim, and certainly hundreds of thousands, if not millions.
Completely untrue.
Okay, so what's the evidence for that people are at least are claiming, and why is it not right?
Well, the evidence that they died is true, undoubtedly. What happened was that in the October of 1942, a gigantic cyclone hit the east coast of India, and it destroyed two things, primarily the rice crops, of course, on which the Bengalis lived and survived, and secondly, the road and rail links that could be used to bring in more rice. You then have, of course, the places that you buy, that the British Empire bought rice in from, Malaya, Thailand, Burma, etc., under Japanese control. Japanese submarines were in the Bay of Bengal, and the Japanese had shelled various cities in 1942 along the coast. It is a complete falsehood to say that Winston Churchill is responsible in any way for this. Firstly, for the famine that developed. Firstly, he did write to the prime ministers of Canada and Australia and to the president of America asking for rice to be brought in as soon as it was possible to do so. Secondly, you know, he was fighting a world war, and there were people on the ground, the viceroy and various British officials in India, who had the primary responsibility for this. Over a million tons of rice and other grains were brought in from abroad. And we had a terrible situation where the Indian provincial councils, I mean, India was self-run at the provincial level by then, were refusing to buy enough food because the prices were going wildly up. And so the idea that Winston Churchill can be singled out by people who do not take the time to go to the cabinet papers like I've done and see the letters that he's writing and the things that he's saying in cabinet. The idea that you could therefore accuse a man of genocide on such paucity of evidence, I think, is absolutely disgraceful. I go into this, as you can imagine, in this book. There's 6-7 pages, which points out the truth of what really happened.
Now, you also point out that he was a philo-Semite. He liked Jews, which was not the prevailing attitude of his class and time.
He was a Zionist who supported the Balfour Declaration.
Right. So why do you think that was?
He'd been brought up with Jews. His father liked Jews. He was somebody who admired the contributions that Jews made to Western civilization. And he thought the Sermon on the Mount was the last word in ethics, as he put it. And he'd represented Jews in his Manchester constituency early on in his career, And he also, there was a sort of perverse side to him that didn't mind taking on
contrarian.
He was a contrarian, of course, and the majority of his age and class and background, people were anti-Semitic at that time, and he took them on and fought them.
And you mentioned the Sermon on the Mount, but I think you also say in your book that he wasn't much of a Christian.
No, he wasn't.
At least as a practicer.
Yes, no. Well, his stance on the Church of England was that he said he was rather like a flying buttress in that he supported it, but from the outside. he didn't much like going to church. He had a sense of what he called the religion of healthy mindedness, which was his own sort of system of ethics. But he was not a Christian. He did believe, though, in an Almighty. Although, theologically, when you look into it carefully, the primary duty of the Almighty was to look after Winston Churchill.
An important job, certainly at one point in world history. I'm glad he seemed to have looked after him with some care, given the scrapes with death that you mentioned
amazing.
Earlier.
Amazing. It's truly extraordinary. I mean, if I could just have one minute to go through them.
Sure.
This is a person who was born 2 months premature, which, of course, in Victorian England is a brush, often a death sentence in itself. He was stabbed in the stomach by a school friend at the age of 10. He nearly died of pneumonia at the age of 11, and on that occasion the doctors administered brandy to the 11-year-old, both orally and rectally, which you would have thought might put you off brandy for life, but certainly didn't in Winston Churchill's case. He was then involved in a boating accident on Lake Geneva when he nearly drowned. He nearly was burned to death in a house fire. He had three car crashes, two plane crashes, and that was just the peacetime close brush with death. In wartime, he was involved in 5 wars on 4 continents. He said that, any number of times did bullets whiz past his ear. He said at one point that there's nothing so exhilarating in life as to be shot at without result. And there was one moment in the First World War, and in the First World War, as commander of a battalion in the First World War, he went into no man's land no fewer than 30 times. And on one occasion, the dugout that he just left 5 minutes earlier suffered a direct hit from a German whiz-bang high explosive, and everyone inside was decapitated.
He must have thought there must have been a point in his life. Certainly, as you say, he thought he was destined for greatness. But there must have been a point in his life where it must have crossed his mind that he might have been immortal.
Well, actually, funny enough, you say that, but at that time when he was writing later about the dugout being destroyed, literally 5 minutes after he'd left it, he said that he felt that he could hear invisible wings beating over him. So that's another sort of example of this sense of destiny and the Almighty. And one can understand why he had that sense that he was walking with destiny.
I want to go back to this point about modern British unease with their imperial past. I have to mention that when I went to London, I asked an English friend of mine what I should do, and he said, "Well, the British Museum, of course." And after I went to the British Museum. And then he listed some other things. The phrase, the British Museum, comma, of course, did not really convey the spectacular nature of the British Museum. I think it's overwhelmingly the finest museum in the world, one of the most extraordinary places to visit. And one of the senses you get from that experience as a non-Englishman is the unimaginable contribution that England and the British Isles have made to world thought, history, science, you name it. So it's at worst a mixed bag.
but equally, I mean, it's full of stuff we pinched.
Oh, it's all,
of course.
Oh, it's all looted.
Yeah.
It's, well, that's part of the unease, right? Because you have the the Elgin Marbles.
Well, they were bought, actually.
I know, but it doesn't matter. People still are ashamed of them.
Not me.
Good for you. I just have to tell the story. You know, I'm wandering in there, and I'm looking at these black onyx Assyrian 15-foot high things. At least I think that's what they were, onyx and Assyrian. And I turned to a docent, and I said, well, those are replicas, right? And she said, oh, no, those are the originals. And I said, people are touching them. She said, hey, they shouldn't. But and across from those...
People were touching them. That's what? Outrageous.
Yeah, well, across from them is an entire temple. And I said, well, that's a recreation, right? Oh, no, they brought that back.
I hope people weren't touching that.
They were not.
We captured the Rosetta Stone off the French, in fact, who had looted it a little bit earlier, a couple of years earlier. We were pleased to be able to get that that off them.
If that were the only thing in the museum, it would be worth visiting. It's one of a zillion things there. But the reason I bring it up, besides the chance to reflect on that, which I enjoy, is the this unease issue and how it plays out today with Brexit. So I certainly have a feeling, and I'd like to get your take on this, that many English people would be very happy to be merely European, whereas the people who voted for Brexit want to reclaim that national identity that is somewhat in disrepute and certainly in somewhat fading.
Well, it's not a desire to go back to the empire, the Leave campaign, in any way. It's a desire to re-engage with the rest of the world in a proper global way, which you can't do if you're stuck in a group of 28 states which are profoundly protectionist, actually quite anti-American as well, when we have the special relationship with the United States that matters to us. And so it's completely wrong to think of it as a kind of isolationist or imperialist impulse at all. It's actually much more an open free market kind of impulse of the 51% who voted for Brexit. As far as the 48% are concerned, yes, you're right. It's a sense of being a European rather than a Briton. But I've never really found it very difficult to explain to Americans why I voted to have Britain go back to being an independent country. The idea of its laws being struck down by a unelected bunch of bureaucrats in Brussels and the judiciary that they appoint is anathema to anybody who understands about sovereignty and independence.
Let's talk about the Churchill War Rooms, which is my other favorite thing in London. These are the below ground rooms that Churchill would repair to in the Battle of Britain when London was under air attack. It includes a kitchen, it includes bedrooms, conference rooms for strategic discussions. It's one of the finest historical experiences that a person can have to be able to walk through those corridors and imagine what it was like in the darkest hour of, in my view, of Western civilization. Reflect on that space.
Yes, it's truly extraordinary and wonderful because it hasn't been changed since 1945. At the end of the
How is that possible?
Because they closed the gates and the doors. They were going to open them again if they needed it in another world war. But thankfully, there hasn't been one. And so in the 1970s, they opened it up to turn it into a museum. And found absolutely everything exactly where it was, down to a couple of cubes of sugar that one of the soldiers there was about to put into his coffee cup and didn't, and there were the sugar lumps. So everything is still there. And you have the bed that Churchill slept in, the room that he spoke to President Roosevelt from. You have the cabinet room, and you can see where everybody sat around, and it's the most
maps,
the maps all over the walls, exactly, and it's easily for me the most evocative museum in the world.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm sure I was close to tears a number of times just imagining what a near thing that was, that that we made it, that the Allies won, because again, with the hindsight, with the value, with the opportunity to look back on it, people can say it was inevitable. America's military industrial power was eventually going to be added to the war. Of course, America's involvement was always in doubt for a long time.
How, if we'd made some kind of ignoble peace with Hitler, where would you have? What was the springboard going to be for you to be able to invade Western Europe? Where would you have done it from? You know, you'd pretty much had to have got across the entire Atlantic, because there's nowhere else geographically to launch it from. You need an unsinkable aircraft carrier, and that, of course, was the United Kingdom. And you're right. In May 1940, Lord Halifax, the Foreign Secretary, wanted to enter peace negotiations with Hitler. And one can see from a logical and rational point of view, with the British Expeditionary Force having left all its tanks and its weaponry and war material on the beaches at Dunkirk, with Russia on Hitler's side as an ally, with the United States very much isolationist and not moving towards bellicosity, one can understand why there seemed to be no chance whatsoever of defeating Germany, which was about to knock France out of the war in a few days' time anyhow. And march into Paris. So Lord Halifax really was taking the logical and rational view. There were other people in the government who agreed with him. And what you needed, therefore, was Churchill as Prime Minister to put the irrational, illogical argument, the romantic argument. And luckily, here was somebody who was entirely driven by his passions and his emotions. This comes through, I think, more than anything else in the course of me researching this book, was how much of a man driven by his emotions and passions he was. And he was not going to, after 10 years of warning against Adolf Hitler and the Nazis and not being listened to, finally, when he became Prime Minister, he was not about to enter into peace negotiations.
So I'm sure you know there's a new documentary out called They Shall Not Grow Old, which is a colorization of World War One footage and addition of sound by the director Peter Jackson. It's an extraordinary achievement. And I think it's important for Americans to watch it because I think Americans and others have no awareness of the role that World War One played in the psyche of Europe in general, and certainly in England in the 1930s. It had only been a little more than a decade. It was so horrific. The fact that England had that France had zero taste for war is totally understandable. They lost enormous amounts of men in the First World War. England did as well, not as much as France, but England lost enormous, if I remember correctly.
1.1 million.
Right. And it's a big number of a population of the time of what? Roughly, I'm going to guess and say it was in the 50 million range.
Less than that.
Maybe 40. So 2.5% of the population is killed in the war, and America's never experienced anything remotely like that. And again, having visited England, you'll tell me the name of the day. Maybe it's just Veterans Day, but you know we have a Veterans Day here in America.
Yeah, Remembrance Day, the 11th of November.
In England, people make a donation and they buy a poppy.
They wear poppies, yes. You give money to the veterans and you wear a poppy to show that you've donated.
And that's a reference to the
poppies on the Western Front. Yes, the way in which
so many died. And so in America, nobody pays any attention to Armistice Day, November 11th. I mean, it's on the calendar, but it. When I was in England on November 11th, it was an enormously focused on experience, obviously. And so, when people complain that everyone was an appeaser and Chamberlain was an appeaser, and I think as you're suggesting, the real news there is that somebody wasn't, because it was a perfectly natural thing to do, not to want to go back to war again.
That's right. But he had spotted in Hitler and the Nazis and was the first person, and for many years the only person, to make the warnings. He knew this because he was an historian and he'd seen previous attempts to hegemonize Europe and destroy the European balance of power. He was a Philo-Semite, and he had an early warning system for what Hitler and the Nazis were like because he liked Jews. He was somebody who had seen fanaticism up close and personal in his own career, fighting in Africa and Asia. And so he was able to spot what Hitler was really all about in a way that a lot of the other prime ministers of the 1930s, who'd never seen fanaticism in their lives, were not able to do. But as you say, and we had, it was only 20 years before that we had lost these enormous numbers of men. And when I watch, you say that you were emotionally affected going around the cabinet war rooms. I actually cried during They Shall Not Grow Old. It was incredibly powerful movie for me and for most people I know. Of course, it's not just the First World War that's commemorated with Remembrance Day, but also the Second World War and Iraq and Afghanistan and Korea and all the other wars that we've had. And the Falklands, exactly. And so when you're wearing the poppy, you're doing it for people who are alive as well as people who are dead.
Well, that's true here too, right? It's on November 11th because that was Armistice Day of World War I. The significance of Veterans Day here in America just isn't the same. Just not. For a whole bunch of reasons. One last thing about the war rooms I want to remark on and get your reaction. As wandering through them, I was struck by two things. First of all, you know, you can buy a tour and you can listen to the tour. The tour is glorious because it includes audio of people who worked there with Churchill and others who reminisce about the experience of what he was like as a employer or manager. And so you might reflect on how he treated the secretaries there if you'd like. I get a kick out of it. But the other thing that struck me is how simple the accommodations are. His bedroom is not as nice as my bedroom today. It's not as nice, I suspect, as your bedroom or most of the people.
It's not as nice as my hotel bedroom.
Right, exactly. and it's not as nice as, I don't know where you're staying, but if you're staying, it's not as nice as a Motel 6 bedroom to take a more, you know, an economy level hotel. It is, Spartan's a bit strong. It's not Spartan. It is what in America would be called sort of lower middle class is the way I would describe it. Maybe not then, but certainly today. And I was, you know, for a person who clearly had grown up in what his time was the lap of luxury and who enjoyed the finer things in life, he did not bring that to that space.
Well, it wasn't important compared to winning the Second World War, and they weren't going to worry about fripperies and you know, nice carpets and curtains when the primary thought of all of them, all of the time, was how to win the war. Also, there was very much a sense in the Second World War that luxury, private luxury in London was not good form when the men were fighting in Africa and Italy and France and so on in much worse circumstances. And so luxury was looked down on by the people around Winston Churchill in that period. They still drank very nice brandy, for example, and so on. But they didn't spend money on things on luxuries. They had they mended and mended their clothes, for example, because of course clothing was rationed from 1939 onwards. And so yes, it is when you go around and see the cabinet war rooms, you're certainly not there in order to see Rococo fireplaces.
But it's not just that; it's that the bed itself is simple. It's not fancy. It's not ornate. And of course, it's, if I remember correctly, it's the size of, I think, a twin bed. He was often there, always there? Wife?
No.
Am I misremembering that?
No, yes, you're misremembering. It's very much a single bed.
That means, yeah, it's narrow. It's maybe...
Yes.
2.5, 3 feet wide.
No, Clementine didn't like sleeping in the same room as him because he snored so loudly, especially after 6 hours of drinking his whiskies and sodas. They only used that room that you saw during the actual bombing, during the Blitz, and so he spent relatively little amount of time there. He actually slept in a bed directly above the rooms that we were in, that we've been in.
And he lied to his wife, I think, about where he was. Didn't he also mislead her at times?
She wanted him to take much more care of himself. He used to go up onto the Air Ministry roof during the Blitz, which, of course, was a tremendously dangerous thing to do. But he had all his life been where the action was. And all his life he'd wanted to, and he writes about this actually, and I quote him in my book, that he believed that you couldn't really understand events unless you were physically there when they were taking place. And so he went out of his way to not court danger for its own sake, but in order to understand what was happening, to actually go to the place where it was happening.
And he also flew a great deal during the war.
Amazing.
Which was remarkably
yes.
dangerous.
Yes, no, exactly. He was the glue that kept the big three together, because, of course, President Roosevelt, very brave considering how profoundly disabled he was, did leave the American continent on several occasions. Stalin was scared of flying and only left the Soviet Union once. But it was very much the job of Churchill to zoom around the world, and he covered 110,000 miles of flying, very often in unpressurized cabins within the radius of the Luftwaffe. And he's in his 70s. And of course, when he took ships across the Atlantic, it was across a U-boat infested ocean. And so the sheer guts, he flew to Moscow twice, was constantly in Cairo. It was a duty, of course. But there's one moment in the war where he spent over 4 months in the year outside the United Kingdom.
I just want to mention before I forget that I do try to be a civil interviewer, as I think listeners appreciate, but it's hard for me to be sufficiently challenging and skeptical of a Churchill biographer. So I apologize to listeners who might expect me to be giving you a harder time, Andrew, because he's been a hero of mine since I was a child. I'm not sure exactly why. I think my father was a big Churchill fan, but my adult admiration and appreciation of his significance does come through when I walk through that war room, because you know, I think when you walk in, there's a summary of the damage done by the Blitz and the attack on the on England by the Luftwaffe in 1940, and it just would have been so easy to give up.
Well, we had over 50,000 civilian deaths as a result of German bombing in the Second World War, and of course they responded in a completely massive way, and the Germans themselves suffered 500,000 deaths. So one has to put it in perspective. Well, they had really reaped the whirlwind.
Yes,
but I think Churchill's leadership in certainly 1941 and 1940, with those morale boosting speeches, the refusal to commit to having peace negotiations with Hitler. And to seeing out the German attack, really was a masterclass in leadership. There's so many aspects of his leadership that I think are fascinating, and many of them do come from the summation of the rest of his life. In that sense, what he said about his past life having been a preparation for this hour and for this trial. You see that again and again, and it's a leitmotif that I've tried to concentrate on throughout the book.
You know, we talked earlier about his overconfidence, hubris, lack of humility, his feeling that he was special and so on. And yet, one of his famous quotes, which I'll paraphrase, and you can quote it probably from heart, I'm sure, by heart, I'm sure, is that he was privileged to represent the British people and to be the lion that gave the roar. And there's a certain humility in that, as if all he did was give a few speeches that stiffened the resolve of the British people. And I think maybe it's a rare moment of humility, but it certainly doesn't accurately describe, as you point out in the book, His contribution.
There's a second sentence, though, that nobody ever refers to. You've got the gist of the first sentence, but then... the second sentence is that he also showed the British Lion where to place its claws. And so what he was trying to say was he was a strategist who, as well as making these speeches and giving the lions roar, he also was key to the overall strategy, the strategy of trying to draw German armour away from northwest France, where he knew the big attack was ultimately going to take place across the Channel, to draw it down into Africa and then into Italy, and to have a Mediterranean strategy that weakened the Germans more than it weakened us, which was indeed the case. And then the day after Rome fell, of course, we had Operation Overlord and D-Day took place. So, even when he was being modest, there was a second sentence in which he was pointing out what he achieved.
There's an enormous appetite in American culture for things British, things royal, things Churchillian, even despite that revisionist stuff we talked about earlier. There have been recently movie, I think it's The Finest Hour is the name of it.
Darkest Hour.
And, of course, The Crown, which in its first two seasons focused quite a bit on Churchill's relationship with the king and with the queen. I'm not a fan of British royalty. I have zero interest in it. And yet I found The Crown to be one of the most riveting pieces of television I've ever seen. Partly the production quality is extraordinary, partly because you're witnessing the kind of retreat that Britain ultimately does make from the world stage, which is, despite the issues we talked about earlier, there's a poignancy there as Churchill and the royal family grapples with that. And the last thing I'll say about The Crown is that you can't have the Queen deciding to take up a professional tennis career, as you can in other miniseries, to keep reader interest, viewer interest. You're stuck with the historical truth.
No, you're not. No, the Crown is complete rubbish from beginning to end.
Okay, yeah, great. That's what I was going to ask
a
you.
Friend of mine.
I was going to ask you if these modern, these cultural visions of history are painful for you to watch as economics are in the movies for me.
I gave up after the third or fourth episode when mistake after mistake, egregious, intended many of them. A friend of mine called Hugo Vickers has written a pamphlet in which he numbers 1,000 factual errors in The Crown. And that's just the first series. So if anybody takes it as history, they must stop doing that right now. It is pure entertainment. It's not even infotainment. It's solely entertainment. So that's the first thing.
Deeply second demoralized. Thing
is. Second thing is that The Darkest Hour is not like that. That actually has an underlying truth to it. It, of course, like all of these shows, compresses some moments, concentrates on others. I thought Gary Oldman's performance was excellent. The way in which he used prosthetics, but also the acting, where he had the chuckle in the voice and the twinkle in the eye, was one of the best characterizations of Churchill ever. It's up there with the great one by Robert Hardy in the 1970s. So you do have very good shows. Of course, there was the moment on the subway that was ludicrous. Entirely, yes. Churchill went on the subway in 1926 and never again. And he didn't. And it also undermines the central theme that, of course, he told the British people that they were going to fight on in 1940. He didn't learn from a focus group that it was the best thing to do.
I despise that, and even as an amateur.
So that was rubbish. But the actual show itself, apart from that single scene, was absolutely superb.
Now, you had access, I mentioned in passing, Churchill's relationship with the king. In writing your book, you had access to the king's diaries.
That's right, yes. The Queen allowed me to be the first Churchill biographer to read her father's diaries. And these were tremendously helpful, of course, because the King met Churchill every Tuesday of the Second World War. They had lunch together. And nobody else could be present, of course, at the audience because the King was trusted by Churchill with all of the great secrets of the Second World War, the ultra decrypts, the nuclear secrets, which generals and admirals were going to be hired and fired, which countries were going to be invaded and so on. And they got on extremely well, and the king wrote everything down. So I was able to be the first Churchill biographer to use these, and I've used them extensively because they really tell the reader what was at the top of Churchill's thinking every Tuesday of the Second World War.
Are there any revelations there? Any surprises?
Loads. There were. I think overall, the major one was that, of course, Churchill was incredibly frustrated at the glacially slow move to bellicosity of the Roosevelt administration. I mean, he, of course, had major isolationist problems politically, but nonetheless, Churchill was scathing in private about how long it was taking the Americans to get involved because he saw the war as a Manichaean struggle between civilization and democracy on one side and the most evil totalitarian dictatorship in world history on the other. And he couldn't understand why the great democracy of the United States was taking so long to make its power and its presence felt.
So I'm going to close with a little bit of skepticism I could bring to this, which is that at the very end of your book, you mentioned that 30%, I think, of British teenagers, 20 or 30%?
20%, yeah.
Of British teenagers think Churchill is a fictional character. Do you believe that survey? And more generally, what is Churchill's reputation among young people in England today?
I totally do believe that survey because he's only taught on the school history curriculum for 14 seconds. You can get through your entire history curriculum and watch a video, which you do have to watch, in which Churchill appears for 14 seconds. And that's what you're taught. We have cut the great men and great women of history out of the school curriculum. It's a disgrace. It's incredibly bad, I think, for national identity, national morale, indeed. But it's been going on for some time. So, yes, in that same survey, by the way, as well as 20% thinking that he was a fictional character, some 47% thought that Sherlock Holmes was a real person, and 53% thought that Eleanor Rigby was a real person.
Wait a minute. That's...
Moronic of them, I know, but
No, I think that's totally understandable.
Really?
Yes, well, given that most of us think Sherlock Holmes is real, he feels real to us. He's vivid.
Uh-oh.
And you can go to Baker Street and you can see his flat, I think.
I think I might have been on the wrong show, Russ.
But let's close with something a little more optimistic, or at least a little more related to history. Do you think he'll come back as a obviously your book is a step in that direction, but do you think that Churchill's reputation will continue to slide, or do you think he will have a bit of a revitalization down the road?
I think actually the things he stood for, the incredible foresight both before the First World War and the Second World War, and then again also in warning about Stalin and the threat to Eastern Europe after the Second World War. So this sense of foresight that he had. I think the way in which he was able to learn from his mistakes, the incredible eloquence that he showed, the way in which he mastered the English language, and also this incredible moral courage that he showed through the 1930s when he was warning about Hitler, but he was shouted down in the House of Commons. They nearly took his parliamentary seat away from him. He had a tax on him constantly, lambasted and ridiculed in the press and elsewhere, and he never changed his message. This is a man who didn't listen to opinion polls, didn't take part in focus groups, didn't have a single speechwriter all his life. He is somebody who, therefore, shows all of the important attributes of leadership. And I don't think that in the world that we're likely to be living in over the next few decades, we're ever going to be able to go without leadership.
My guest today has been Andrew Roberts. His book is Churchill, Walking with Destiny. Andrew, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Thank you so much, Russ.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.